Welcome to Mystery Books Podcast. I'm mystery author Sarah Rosette. This is Season 5, Episode 5, and it's all about Chapters 7 and 8 of Murder at Archley Manor. Murder at Archley Manor was published in 2018, and it's book 1 of 8 in the High Society Lady Detective series. Now, before we talk about Murder at Archley Manor, I want to give you my recent read. Right now, I am reading Every Time I Go on Vacation, Someone Dies. It's by Catherine Mack, M-A-C-K. And it is about a woman named Eleanor Dash. She is a best-selling author on a book tour in Italy. And she's also plotting her next book, which she plans to kill off a character who is based on a real-life person in this book. But then the real-life Connor has a brush with death, and things get very complicated. It's a very fun read. It's got footnotes, which I love, and it has very contemporary narration. If you only enjoy classic mysteries in my classic mystery recommendations, then this probably isn't for you. But if you enjoy books like Finley Donovan is Killing It, then you'll probably like this book. So I love that it's set in Italy, and I'm really enjoying the Italian ambiance. So I thought I'd give you some other travel mysteries that are read-alikes for this book. You could always pick up Elusive, which is my book. It's the first in the On the Run series. There's another book called A Cruise to Die For by Charlotte Elkins, and that takes place on a cruise ship in the Mediterranean. Then there is also Hazards in Hampshire by Emma Dakin, and that is, I got to read an early copy of that book and provide a blurb for it, and it's a fun look at a tour guide who specializes in locations in England related to mystery books. And then there's also a whole series by Jennifer S. Alderson called, well, the first book in the series is Death on the Danube, and it's also about a travel operator who has a series of books set in different European locations. So all those titles will be in the show notes so that you can find them easily. So thanks to NetGalley and St. Martin's Press for an early review copy of Every Time I Go on Vacation, Somebody Dies. I appreciated getting an early look at this book. You can find the links to this book as well as the other travel mysteries that I talked about. Those will all be in the show notes, and those are affiliate links. They will take you directly to the stores that you select. All right, so now let's go back to Murder at Archley Manor, chapters 7 and 8. So for this chapter, these two chapters, I thought we would talk about the parties of the 1920s because they were the inspiration for these two chapters. The fictional silver and gold party that Olive attends at Sebastian Blakely's Archley Manor was inspired by these crazy parties of the 1920s. Now, most of these parties that I'm going to talk about today took place in the later half of the 1920s. So I had used a little leeway and made one of these extravagant parties earlier in the 1920s. But the heyday of these amazing over-the-top parties was the late 1920s and early 1930s. I'll just tell you a little bit about the parties I researched before writing about the silver and gold party. All these parties had themes, and they were put on by the bright young things, the young people that most of the time they were too young to have been in World War I. And this kind of wild lifestyle was a little bit of a reaction to the somberness and the sadness from the First World War. Looking back, it's easy to see that the pendulum was kind of swinging in the opposite direction. They wanted to move away from the melancholy of that previous era. And so one way they did that was they threw these amazing parties. So there was, most of them had themes. There was the circus party, the Wild West party, the baby party, or like it was also called the infant party. And some people came in prams and dressed up like babies. And then there was another series of parties called the bath and bottle parties, where the young people hired a pool and they had the guests bring alcohol in their swimsuits. And oftentimes they'd have like a band playing and it would go on all night and the neighbors would call the police. It was quite extravagant. So I'll give you a couple of details about the circus party, which was held in 1929. And they had wolves, horses, dancing bears, people dressed up as these things. And the host dressed as a ringmaster. And it was pretty wild. One guest rode her pony up the stairs, apparently. And then there was another party, the Mozart party, where people came in 18th century clothing, including powdered wigs. According to the Londonist article about this party, it says, according to the actress Brenda Dean Paul, it cost nearly £3,000, the equivalent of over £180,000 in today's money. So that was for the Mozart party. Now, the details on the wolves, horses, and the dancing bear and the ringmaster from the circus party are also from the Londonist article. And I will link to that in the show notes in case you're interested in taking a look at that. Now, there was even a very famous party planner of the 1920s and 30s, and her name was Eliza Maxwell. And she was well known for hosting these parties for the rich and famous and creating these fun, unusual games. Apparently, there was a treasure hunt party in Paris in the late 20s that caused chaos all over Paris because of the lengths people were willing to go to find items for the treasure hunt. She was also hired by cities and countries to popularize destinations, including Venice and Monaco. And if you're interested in more things about these amazing parties, you can check out book 5 in the High Society series called An Old Money Murder in Mayfair. And it is a fictional murder mystery party that kind of goes awry. And I researched a lot of Eliza Maxwell's parties for that book as well. So if you're interested in more about the parties, check out An Old Money Murder in Mayfair. So I used all of these parties as inspiration for the fictional Silver and Gold Party in Murder at Archley Manor. And it's hosted by Sebastian Blakely and takes place at Archley Manor. All of this is, you know, completely made up, but it's based on these over-the-top parties in the 1920s. I just included everything I could think of to make it extravagant. There's fireworks, there's amazing food, there's plenty of antics because these parties tended to get out of control. And it's also a great setting for a murder mystery. So here is Elizabeth Klett narrating chapters 7 and 8 of Murder at Archley Manor.
Chapter 7. Gwen and I set out from London for Somerset, and the first portion of the drive was uneventful. It was only after we turned off the main road that we realised Alfred's vague directions left something to be desired. As we approached a crossroads with a faded signpost, I said to Gwen, "Slow down so I can read it. I think this may be our turn." Gwen's foot touched the brake, something she'd rarely done since we'd set off from my lodgings. Gwen, so sedate and measured in her personality, lost all inhibition when she got behind the steering wheel. Her philosophy was to power along at as fast a pace as possible, saying, "If we're wrong, we'll turn around," which we'd already done twice. I looked back down to the page of scrawled directions. "Yes, take a right here." Gwen made the turn, then stood on the brake, flinging the directions and the map to the floor. "What is that?" Arms braced on the dash, I said, "I have no idea." Now that we'd made the turn, a life-size figure of a clown pointing down the road came into view. Gwen let the motor roll closer. "It's papier-mâché," I said. It was clothed in a bright harlequin-patterned suit and had a matching floppy hat. "Sebastian is a bit unconventional," Gwen said. "Perhaps these are signposts to point the way to Archley Manor." "It would have been more helpful to have one at the actual crossroad," I said. Gwen returned her attention to the road, and the Morris surged forward. "Sebastian's an artist. He's more into theatre than practicality." We saw three more papier-mâché figures, a mermaid, a knight, and finally a unicorn, which guarded the gates of Archley Manor. "They certainly are eye-catching," I said as we passed through the gates. "It makes me wonder what's in store for this party." Nothing traditional, that's for certain. The grounds of Archley Manor were extensive, and it was several minutes before the house came into view. Gwen tapped the brake so I could get a good look. Gracious, I said. Perhaps I should become a society photographer. The white stuccoed mansion dazzled against the green background of the surrounding parkland. A two-story recessed portico lined with Ionic pillars formed the central block of the house. Above it, a balcony enclosed the second floor. Two wings, each with an octagonal design, bookended the entrance block. Family money. Violet says Sebastian bought Archley Manor so he could get away. Somewhere to go and he wants to get out of the hustle and bustle of London. Pity that it's family money and not his photos that paid for it. I could see myself becoming the dashing lady photographer. The drive leading to the house buzzed with activity. Gwen threaded between two lorries, then stomped on the brakes to avoid a servant pushing a barrow full of plants. She swept the motor around the man, then jerked us to a stop at the portico by the double front doors. A servant opened the door of the Morris and informed Gwen he'd put the Morris in the old stables, then have our bags sent up to our rooms. He drove away around the side of the house. Gwen and I stood on the sweep for a moment, taking in the activity. On the wide stretch of emerald lawn that gradually dropped down to a lake, gardeners were trimming the grass while others bent over the flower beds that surrounded the house. Several men in flat caps and work clothes carried boxes labelled explosives down to a boathouse, while servants hurried back and forth from one of the side entrances to the house. Other workers tottered along with potted plants or perched on ladders as they hung Japanese lanterns on tree branches. A man emerged from Archley Manor's front door. He held two green champagne bottles by their gold-wrapped necks and wore a three-piece suit with a gold watch chain across his vest. He transferred one of the bottles to the crook of his arm and came toward Gwen, his hand extended. He moved with a confident and leisurely stride. "Gwen, so glad you could come." His fair hair was parted in the middle of his forehead and slicked back from his face, which was lean and bordered on gauntness. The sunlight highlighted his prominent cheekbones and the sockets around his eyes, giving him an almost skull-like appearance. The skin stretched tight over the bones of his face was a curious contrast to his obvious youthfulness. He couldn't be more than a few years older than Gwen and me. He was in his early 30s at the most. I wondered if he'd been sick recently. "Hello, Sebastian," Gwen said. "I don't think you've met my cousin, Olive." I shook his hand. His grip was strong and his handshake firm. I said, "I hope crashing your party at the last moment hasn't caused any problems." "Not at all. We're informal here, as you can see." He lifted one of the champagne bottles. "In fact, we're having a little pre-party party, if you'd like to join us. We're picnicking far away from this chaos." He waved the champagne bottle at a servant carrying a stack of chairs. "Or you may retire to your rooms if your journey was too fatiguing." He smiled as he said the words, but there was a critical edge to his tone, which also held the barest trace of ridicule. "Perhaps you'd like a bit of a rest?" "I'm not as missish as that," Gwen said, "and I know Olive won't want a rest." "No, I love a picnic." "Excellent. This way." He turned his back to the lawn that sloped down to the lake and led us around to the other side of the house. "We're under that large chestnut tree. If you'll excuse me for a moment, I must speak to someone. I'll be with you shortly." He moved away to talk to one of the workers. I raised my eyebrows at Gwen as we walked to the group gathered under the tree. "I can see why you don't like him." Gwen's steps paused. "I never said that." "You didn't have to. I could tell from the way you spoke about him. Meeting him only confirmed my thoughts." "Really? That's disturbing. Do you think he knows I don't like him?" "No. He's far too pleased with himself to even wonder about what other people think of him." "Yes, smug down to his very bones. That's why I worry about Violet. Alfred is so closely connected to Sebastian, and it's clear that Sebastian doesn't think of anyone but himself. I'm afraid Alfred is cut from the same cloth. And neither one of them has Violet's best interests at heart. Yes, Gwen said, then glanced back at Sebastian, who was still by the house. He thinks I'm a dried-up busybody out to spoil everyone's enjoyment. That comment about needing a nap, as if I was Violet's decrepit spinster aunt. Just because I don't indulge in the frivolous life like he and his friends doesn't mean I'm old-fashioned. You don't have to convince me. She smiled. Sorry. He does annoy me. As we approached the group in the shade of the tree, Violet, who was seated on a blanket and reclining against Alfred's chest, shifted into a sitting position. Alfred rose and greeted us warmly, his grin wide. Violet didn't look nearly as welcoming. "I thought you weren't coming," she said. "You must have misunderstood," Gwen said. "I said I was arriving later. I went to London to bring Olive." Gwen turned to introduce me to two women in wicker chairs with fashion magazines spread across their laps. The woman closest to me was Lady Pamela. Like the day I'd met her with Jasper at the Savoy, she wore an exquisite gown, this one a flowing cream silk with a lace overdress. "Lady Pamela and I have met," I said. She tilted her head up slightly, so the wide brim of her straw hat revealed one eye. "I'm afraid I don't recall." "It was at the Savoy." "How nice! With Jasper Rimmington." Her eye narrowed. "Oh, yes, now I remember. You were in that rather, intriguing frock. Of course, I'm sure you had no idea you were dining at the Savoy. Jasper is rather a dear, absolutely spontaneous, and he associates with such eccentric people." Lady Pamela's gaze travelled up and down my ensemble, which was a perfectly acceptable tricot dress in pale green, but beside her frothy garden party dress, I knew I looked dowdy, and she was making sure everyone knew it. I tilted my head. And I thought Jasper just enjoyed my arresting eyes and first-class brain. Gwen coughed as Lady Pamela's eye became a slit. Before Lady Pamela could launch into a speech, Gwen cleared her throat and indicated the woman seated in the next chair. "Olive, this is Mrs. Reed, Sebastian's sister. She's staying here at Archley Manor with him while her husband is in Brazil." She dropped her magazine and extended her hand. "Call me Thea, everyone does." Her clothing was in the same league as Lady Pamela's, and her brunette hair was bobbed, but Thea Reed was probably about 10 or 15 years older than Lady Pamela, who I knew was in her mid-20s. Thea's plump cheeks were just beginning to show a tendency toward jowls, and her heavily powdered skin looked worn compared with Violet's dewy fresh complexion. I shook hands with Thea. "Will your husband return from Brazil soon?" "Not for months and months. I'd join him, of course, but it's quite primitive there. Certainly not acceptable for the children. And someone has to oversee the workmen." She motioned for me to sit in an empty chair beside her and settled back. "We're updating the London flat. It's completely uninhabitable. Workers in and out all day. It's too fatiguing, and they never seem to do anything right the first time." Thea held up two magazines folded back at different pages. "What do you think for the cocktail cabinet? The black lacquer with Bakelite or the walnut with chrome?" "You can't go wrong with either one," I said. Thea looked critically from one page to the other. "I've engaged Monsieur Babin. He's terribly difficult to get, you know, and he assures me either one will look stunning, but I can't decide." Lady Pamela shifted in her chair, and her handkerchief fell to the ground. Gwen reached out to pick it up, but Lady Pamela snatched it up in a jerky motion. "Just pick the most expensive one. You always do," Thea said. "I always say it never pays to be cheap." At that moment, a boy of about 7 dropped from the branches of the tree and landed lightly beside me. My startled reaction delighted him, and he giggled. Thea slapped the magazines down and craned her neck to look around the trunk of the tree. "Muriel!" I hadn't seen the two people on the far side of the wide tree trunk. a young woman in her early 20s quickly stepped forward. The high waist of her plain grey dress with a full skirt was several years out of date, but her brunette hair was bobbed and lay against her creamy skin, which was now tinged with pink. She sent a sharp look at the boy beside me. He smothered his laughter. She asked, "Yes, Mrs. Reed?" A man who had been standing behind the tree strolled over. He had a receding hairline, and his expensive suit almost disguised his thickening middle. Thea said, "Take Paul and Rose back to the nursery. They've had enough time outdoors." "Yes, Mrs. Reed." Gwen indicated the young woman as she said, "Olive, this is Muriel Webb. Muriel, this is my cousin, Olive Belgrave." Muriel murmured, "How do you do?" But her attention was on Paul. She took his hand, and a girl a few years younger than the boy scrambled down the trunk of the tree without help. She dropped the last few feet and landed with a smack beside the man with the receding hairline. He stepped back a pace and examined his trousers for mud. Rose craned her neck and asked him, "Will you be back tonight?" He shook his head. "No, I have to go into town." Thea waved the magazine. "Don't bother Mr. Digby Stratham, Rose. Go along with Muriel. Mum will come up and see you before the party tonight." As Muriel walked away with the children, Thea twisted around and called, "Muriel, did you take care of that letter?"
"I put it in the mail this morning."
"All right." She half turned back to our group, then twisted around again. "And what about the striped wallpaper? Did you telephone Monsieur Babin?"
"Yes, it's available, but only in blue, not gold."
"Oh, so frustrating," Thea said as she settled back in her chair. "I so wanted the gold."
Gwen caught my eye and gestured to the man with the receding hairline who'd been standing on the other side of the tree with Muriel. "And this is the last of our party. Olive, this is Hugh Digby Stratham." We shook hands, and then I asked, "You're not staying for the party tonight?" He looked as if a foul odour had drifted his way.
"No, I'm afraid I can't."
Lady Pamela, who had twisted her handkerchief around her fingers, unwound it.
"What Hugh means is he doesn't participate in shallow things. He's far too serious for anything fun."
Hugh did seem to have a starchy personality with his erect posture and his precise movements, but he clearly didn't like Lady Pamela's insinuation he was stodgy.
"On the contrary," he said, "I would rather stay, but duty calls."
He turned back to me.
"I'm afraid I must run. It was a pleasure to meet you."
He took his leave of the rest of the group, then marched off across the lawn toward the house with a military stride. Alfred, who had flopped back down onto the blanket after standing to greet me, plucked a grape from the food spread on the blanket.
"Hard to believe stuffy old Hugh has actually gone and fallen in love,"
Gwen said. "I don't see why you think it's so surprising." Gwen offered me a sandwich from the picnic basket. I took one, along with Thea, but Lady Pamela waved the plate away and shifted in her chair. Gwen set the plate down. "I think she and you will get on well together." With mock horror in his voice, Alfred said,
"But she's a governess. I bet Hugh had to talk his family around to that."
"Muriel comes from excellent stock," Thea said to Alfred. "The Webbs were an established and well-respected Dartmoor family."
Violet twisted to look around to Thea.
"Were?"
"Her parents were killed when she was young."
"Both of them?" Violet asked. "What happened?"
Gwen widened her eyes.
"Violet?"
Thea waved a hand.
"It's all right, Gwen. Muriel wouldn't mind. Water under the bridge and all that. Her parents were killed in a motor smash."
"That's terrible."
"Yes, I'm sure it was," Thea said as she turned the pages of the magazine.
"What happened to her?" Violet asked.
Thea pulled her gaze away from a dress advertisement.
"Who?"
"Muriel, after her parents died."
"Oh, Muriel. She was sent to live with an aunt. Apparently they didn't get on well, but it all worked out in the end."
Thea closed the magazine and picked up another.
"Because of that experience, Muriel understands the importance of stability where the children are concerned. She's wonderful at keeping up with my correspondence and my schedule, too. So helpful and willing to do whatever is needed. She was kind enough to step in when my previous secretary left.
I thought Muriel might have another perspective on her relationship with Thea. The peremptory way Thea had spoken to Muriel, and Muriel's quick, almost guilty response, told me Muriel was much more interested in keeping her position as Thea's governess secretary than simply helping Thea. As someone who was desperate for a job, I recognised the signs. Sebastian arrived and topped off the champagne flutes for those who already had them, and handed new glasses to Gwen and me. He caught the end of the conversation and said, "Muriel'll be a perfect political hostess, just what Hugh needs, actually. She'll fade into the background, as a proper politician's wife should. She doesn't have enough beauty to distract press attention, or anyone else's for that matter, from Hugh at all those dreadful ribbon-cutting ceremonies and summer fetes in their future." I thought his words were harsh. Muriel wasn't unattractive. She wasn't as much of a natural beauty as someone like Lady Pamela, and Muriel obviously didn't have the means of someone like Thea, who used beautiful clothes and cosmetics to delay slipping fully into a matronly stage. But Sebastian was a photographer. Perhaps he analysed everyone with an artistic eye, assessing whether or not a person was beautiful. Thea turned a page of her new magazine with a sigh. "Nothing's official yet between Muriel and Hugh, but I can see which way things are going. I'm sure it will be announced soon. The Digby Strathams recognise what a level-headed girl Muriel is. She's circumspect and attentive to detail. But I am disappointed. I'll have to go through the horrid business of finding a new secretary and a new governess. So tiresome." If I'd heard those words a day or two earlier, I'd have made it my objective to show Mrs. Reed what a good candidate I would be for Muriel's replacement. But I was more interested in Alfred's background at the moment. With that thought in mind, I moved to pick up some grapes from the picnic basket, then settled on the blanket near Alfred and Violet. They didn't look thrilled when I joined them, but Violet was too well-bred to not at least make an effort to include me in the conversation. Unfortunately, the conversation centred on the upcoming party, evening gowns in particular. When we exhausted that topic, Violet squeezed Alfred's arm. "But I'm looking forward to the fireworks most of all," she said, then turned to me. "Alfred and I are going to watch them from the balcony at the back of the house." She fixed her gaze back on Alfred. "It'll be too, too romantic." Alfred tossed away several pieces of grass he'd been stripping apart and said, in a disinterested tone, "It has the best view." I said, "We're boring Alfred with all this talk about the party. Which of your friends are coming tonight, Alfred?" "Several of the gang will be here." Alfred stood up and extended his hand to Violet. "Come on, Vi, let's stroll. If they're finished using the boats to get the fireworks over to the island, we can punt about a bit." I watched Alfred and Violet walk away. I couldn't chase after them and demand to be included in their boating party. That would be far too obvious. So I switched my attention to Sebastian, who was saying,
"Well, it wasn't quite cricket, but we used to challenge some pompous-looking city gents to a race and taunt them until they agreed. I'm sure Monty will deny this when he arrives, but it was his idea. I'd make a fuss, marking off a starting point on the pavement, very official-like. Then I'd shout, 'Go!' and they'd dash off. Monty would drop back and let the other chap have the lead. Then, as soon as they ran by a bobby, Monty would yell, 'Stop, thief!' The bobby would sprint off after Mr. Upstanding Citizen, while Monty and I raced in the other direction."
"How wonderfully terrible," Lady Pamela said. "You were awful."
"Yes, I was." Sebastian turned to Gwen. "But I'm sure you don't approve."
"It sounds as if it was all in good fun," Gwen said.
"Oh, it was."
"You must tell them about the rag you pulled at university," Thea said. "That one tops all the others."
"I don't think I have time. I must check."
"You must!" Lady Pamela bounced in her chair. "I insist!"
"Well then, I know Gwen will disapprove of this joke. I have no excuse, except that I was younger,
and much more arrogant. Gwen choked a bit on her tea, but managed to keep a straight face. Sebastian gave her a long look, then cleared his throat. A visiting scholar came to our college, and he was given the royal treatment, given a tour, wined and dined, the whole bit. We decided a few weeks later that another Nobel Prize-winning chemist from Germany would drop in unexpectedly for a visit. Dr. Klaus Klausenstein. He threw his hand out in a theatrical manner and pronounced the name with a heavy German accent. "Who is that?" Lady Pamela asked. "No one," Sebastian said. "We made it all up." Sebastian put his hand on his chest and bowed. "You're looking at the good doctor now." "Didn't someone recognize you?" Gwen asked. "No, I wore glasses, and I had a large fedora pulled down low. I also glued on a spectacularly curly moustache." "You speak German?" I asked. "Not a word," Sebastian said, his grin seeming to cause the skin to strain over the bones of his face. I nodded and smiled. Even the dean was taken in. It was all going swimmingly, until Dr. Heidelberg wanted to chat. "What happened?" I asked, suspecting I knew the answer. Sebastian was far too shrewd to get caught. "I had my assistant, a chap who wasn't at university, translate I was unwell and had to leave immediately, which I must do now," he said as everyone laughed. Sebastian stood, saying he needed to check on the party preparations. As he walked away, Lady Pamela jumped up from her chair as well. "I must decide what to wear for dinner." She turned to Thea. "You must come look at my dresses. The silver embroidered frock I picked up in Paris last month. Too much?" Thea stood and shook out the folds of her dress. Nothing is ever too much for one of Sebastian's parties. Later that evening, I stood in front of the looking glass in my bedroom, which was decorated in a pale green and furnished with a massive canopied bed. The maid who had unpacked my meagre belongings earlier that day handed me my only jewellery, Mum's opera-length string of pearls. They felt cool against the back of my neck. I doubled the necklace so that one section formed a choker, while the rest of it draped in a longer loop. I powdered my nose and added a touch of red lipstick. The maid, Jane, a young woman with her white blonde curls under her maid's cap, stood behind me. Her black gown blended into the shadows, except for the bright white slash of my gloves, which she held in her hands. I turned away from the mirror, and the pearls swung as I took the gloves from Jane.
"Will there be anything else, miss?"
"No, that will be all. Thank you." Jane left, closing the door behind her. I smoothed the gloves up over my elbows. Unlike Lady Pamela, I had no trouble choosing my ensemble for the evening. Having only one choice tends to simplify things. In the shadows of my scruffy London room, the dress had looked fine. But against the sumptuous background of Archley Manor, it seemed homespun. I adjusted my sash and departed for the drawing room. I wasn't here to show off my clothes. I was here to find out about Alfred, and the party should be a perfect opportunity to do it. Chapter 8. I entered the drawing room, which I was surprised to see was decorated in a traditional blue toile. I'd expected something much more eccentric, but it appeared Sebastian limited his unconventional taste to papier-mâché. I glanced around the room and realised my sewing skills fell far short of the gorgeous gowns Lady Pamela and Thea wore. I felt dowdy, but at least I got the long strand of pearls correct. Everyone was wearing ropes of them. Violet, Lady Pamela, Thea and Gwen were draped in them. Sebastian handed me a cocktail. "You're enchanting this evening." I sipped the drink, trying to decide if he was serious or mocking. "Thank you." "Simple lines suit you." With Sebastian's reputation for making cutting remarks, I initially thought the comment was a snub, but his expression looked as if he was dispassionately assessing my outfit. I decided I'd assume he was viewing me with an artist's eye, instead of voicing an insult couched in pretty words. Thea moved closer to me and fingered the tulle of the overdress.
Lovely. Where did you find this?
At a little shop in London.
You must give me its name.
She gestured with her glass at Sebastian. He's always telling me to cut the flounces and flourishes, but I do love them so.
Thea's ensemble, while cut in a simple tube-like style, was decorated with a dizzying combination of metallic gold embroidery, pink bugle beads, and pearl trim at the neck and hem. A feathered hair clip held back one side of her bob, and a rope of pearls fell below the dropped waist of her gown. Good manners dictated I should return her compliment, but the only word that came to mind to describe her gown was overwhelming, and I couldn't say that.
Your pearls are beautiful.
Sebastian lifted his glass in a faint salute, his eyes dancing with laughter. Thea patted her necklace.
Mr. Reed brought these back after a business trip to Shanghai. 150 perfectly matched pearls. Always buy the best, that's what I always say. Mr. Reed agrees with me. He says buying second rate is a false economy.
Sebastian said, It's bad enough he spouts his maxims constantly. Must you continue to do it while he's absent?
Really, Sebastian, you're incorrigible. I don't know why I put up with you.
Because I'm housing and feeding you, not to mention your brats.
Sebastian offered his arm to me.
Come, Olive, have you met the rest of the house guests?
He leaned closer as we moved away from Thea, who was sputtering.
Well done, my dear. Her pearls are exquisite, and the only thing worth admiring, certainly not that horror of a dress.
Sebastian steered me around the room, introducing me to the remaining guests. The last two members of the dinner party arrived shortly before the meal was announced. Monty Park was tall and fair and had a hearty laugh. I'd danced with him at a hunt ball, where he'd stepped on my toes rather heavily. I didn't know the other young man, who was called Tug. He was short and red-headed, and seemed to spend most of his time staring at Lady Pamela. He had to make a conscious effort to pull his gaze away from her when Sebastian introduced me to him. I didn't have a chance to talk with either Monty or Tug, because the butler, Babcock, announced dinner was served. 10 of us sat down to dinner in the dining room, with its mahogany wainscoting, red-papered walls, and spectacularly ornate plasterwork ceiling. Work-conscious Hugh was absent, but Sebastian's secretary, James Henley, a serious, bespectacled young man, joined us. He was seated beside me at dinner, and explained in great detail the trickiness of electrifying Archley Manor while preserving parquet floors, ceiling frescoes, and priceless wood panelling.
"It sounds challenging," I said.
"It was."
James looked across the table to Muriel.
"You caught the end of it when you returned from Paris. Muriel can tell you what a mess everything was."
"Yes, it was hard to do lessons with all the knocking and banging," she said.
The silence stretched, and I cast around for a topic to keep the conversation rolling.
"Do you travel often, Muriel? Have you been to the States?"
"Oh, no. I only travel with Mrs. Reed. She went to Paris, and I accompanied her."
"I see. Did you enjoy it?"
"Very much so."
I was glad Monty asked me a question, and I could turn my attention to him, because conversation with Muriel was hard going. Monty did remember the Hunt Ball.
"I fear I didn't make a good impression," he said, "or rather that I made too deep of an impression on your shoes. I have to apologise. Dancing is not my forte."
"What do you enjoy?"
"I'm a bit of a sportsman. I enjoy golf and horses."
"Buying horses or riding them?" I asked. Before Monty could answer, Alfred, who was seated across the table from me, asked,
"Or betting on them?"
Monty gave him a tight smile, and I had the impression that Monty didn't appreciate Alfred's comment.
"A bit of all three."
He stared at Alfred for a moment, then said,
"There's no law against any of those, is there?"
"No, indeed," Alfred said, his already large grin stretching wide.
"Don't let's talk about horses," Violet said, and turned to Sebastian. "Do you have musicians coming tonight? Or will it have to be the gramophone?
My dear, would I throw a party without proper music? Of course, I invited a nice little orchestra down from London. They're setting up now.
Wonderful, Violet said.
Alfred said, Then perhaps Muriel will serenade us this evening.
Muriel flushed. Tonight is for dancing.
Violet, who was seated next to Alfred, tapped his arm.
Beast! Why would you say that? You know Muriel can't...
Muriel smiled at Violet.
You don't have to be delicate about it, Violet. I can't carry a tune to save my life. Alfred likes to tease me about it.
Well, he shouldn't, Violet said, then turned to Alfred with a bounce.
I know. Why don't you sing for us tonight, Alfred?
He shook his head. No, Muriel is right. Tonight is for dancing. Lady Pamela, who was seated beside Sebastian, put her hand on his arm.
I want to know about this music in America that's all the rage. You were just there. Tell us about it.
That was several months ago, Sebastian said. Lady Pamela twitched a shoulder and adjusted her necklace.
But you heard the music, didn't you? You went to shows.
She reached up to smooth her hair. She'd been constantly moving her hands throughout dinner, twisting the rings on her fingers or fiddling with her silverware. Of course.
Well then, tell us.
Lady Pamela waved off a footman offering the next course. I was seated diagonally across the table from her and could see she ate like one of Jasper's society girls. She mostly pushed the food around her plate and ate only a few bites. Sebastian grinned at her. Scandalous stuff, let me tell you. Wild and loose-limbed, and sure to drive the papers to declare it will cause the downfall of society.
Superb! You must demonstrate, Lady Pamela said.
Oh, no, I'm not that talented. You'll have to go to the clubs in London to see the real thing. The foxtrot is as wild as I get.
Spoil sport, Lady Pamela said with a pout.
It was only after dinner that things began to get a little wild. Motor after motor arrived and disgorged glittering partygoers who fell on the buffet tables in the reception hall like swarms of locusts. They danced in the ballroom and poured out onto the terrace. As the rooms became more and more crowded, the guests eventually spilled onto the lawn that went down to the lake. As the number of partygoers climbed, I inched my way around the ballroom. My hopes of buttonholing Monty or Tug, who I'd learned were friends of Alfred's, were totally impractical. After dinner, Violet had recruited me to fix a comb that had fallen out of her hair. I'd asked if Monty and Tug were Alfred's friends. She'd said,
Yes, I suppose so. He does mention them often.
Violet was determined to dance every dance, so she and Alfred constantly circled the floor as best they could among the sea of glittering dresses and black ties, but neither Monty nor Tug were around them, and I didn't see either of the men anywhere in the ballroom. Thinking they might be in another part of the ground floor, I went into the hallway that connected the ballroom with the entry to the house, the Rococo reception hall with its gilded Georgian portraits and landscapes. People were rushing back and forth through the corridor. Screams, shrieks, and applause sounded from the direction of the reception hall. In the midst of all the movement, a still figure in the shadows against the wall caught my attention. It was Thea, seated in a chair, listening to one side, her fingertips pressed to her forehead. I went across to her.
"Are you all right?"
Thea moved her hand an inch and squinted at me.
"I'm afraid I'm not feeling well. One of my migraines coming on."
Her face was washed out and had a pinched look. A giggling, squealing group of young women hurried by. Thea grimaced and covered her eyes.
"Is there anything I can do for you?" I asked.
"Lady Pamela was supposed to bring me one of her headache powders. She said they work wonders, but she disappeared." Thea motioned down the hall without opening her eyes. I believe she went into the dining room.
"I'll see if I can find her for you."
The dining room was deserted, except for a woman sitting in a man's lap in the chair at the head of the table. They were very involved and didn't notice me. I closed the door and moved to the next room, a sitting room.
I opened the door, and Lady Pamela jumped up from the seat beside a cherrywood pie-crust table. Two young women beside her started and turned. "Lady Pamela," I said, "Thea is waiting for you." Lady Pamela rushed toward me, grabbed both my hands, and swung me around in a circle. "Oh, Olivia, didn't I tell you Sebastian gives the most divine parties? Just too, too divine." I was too startled to remind her my name was Olive, not Olivia, as I noticed the pupils of her eyes were enormous, leaving only a thin line of her green irises around the dark centre. She twirled me around once more, then released me, and I bumped into the pie-crust table and sent the flower arrangement on it rocking. Lady Pamela dashed out the door with the other two young women. As I steadied the vase, Lady Pamela reappeared in the doorway. "My handbag! I must have left... Here it is." The bag had to be hers, because the sparkly black and silver sequins matched her dress exactly. It lay on the table, half open, the contents spilling out. I replaced a compact and a cigarette case, and reached for the handkerchief. When I picked up the gauzy fabric, two bright jewels fell onto the table, square-cut emeralds edged in rows of diamonds. The facets of the stones reflected against the polished grain of the tabletop. I was surprised Lady Pamela wasn't wearing such beautiful jewels, but perhaps she'd decided green didn't go with her black dress. I replaced the jewellery in the bag. Lady Pamela snatched the bag from me and rushed out the door again. My fingers felt gritty, and I rubbed my thumb across my fingertips. A layer of fine powder coated my fingers. I went back to the pie-crust table and switched on the light beside the flower arrangement. Specks of white powder dusted the shiny surface. I returned to Thea and found her in exactly the same position as I'd left her. She asked, "Did you find the headache powders?" "No, and I don't think you should take any type of powder from Lady Pamela. I'm sure the housekeeper will have something you can take." "Yes, I suppose Mrs. Foster will have something. I should go to my room, I think." She said the words as if she were contemplating a trek to the Arctic. She could barely keep her eyes open against the glare of the lights coming from the reception hall, and she cringed at every loud noise. I couldn't leave her in this rowdy crowd. "Let me help you." I reached for her elbow and steadied her as she came to her feet. We moved slowly down the hallway and emerged into the reception hall. "Oh, my," Thea said. A young man in evening attire was perched on a silver platter at the top of the stairs at the centre of the red carpet runner. Anyone would have looked absurd poised at the top of the stairs, seated on a massive serving tray, but against the ornate flourishes of the plasterwork on the walls and the formal Georgian artwork, he looked even more ridiculous. Someone shouted, "Go!" and he rocketed down the staircase on the platter as if it were a sled. I'd never actually seen a cowboy ride a wild horse, but I supposed it would look something like the young man bucking and bouncing along the treads. He landed on the marble floor with a clatter, and a chorus of applause broke out. Thea leaned against my arm. "I don't know if I can... I mean, will they let us through, do you think?" "I'll see that they do." I turned so that I wasn't facing Thea, and said in a loud voice, "Coming through! Excuse us! She needs some air!" I counted on the fact that these partygoers were familiar with people who couldn't handle their drink, and everyone scurried out of our way. With my arm under Thea's elbow, we climbed the now deserted stairs. Once we reached the first landing, the voices surged again as they resumed their sledding game. A footman waited at the landing. He came forward, his hand up as if to bar our way, but then he recognised Thea. He stepped back and let us pass. As I helped her up the last flight of stairs, I asked, "Why is the footman blocking the stairs?" "Oh, Sebastian always does that when he has a party." Her voice was faint. I could tell going up the stairs was a great effort for her, so I wasn't going to ask anything else, but she went on. "No guests above the ground floor. It's his single rule. His studio and photography equipment are upstairs. He's extremely particular about them. He doesn't care a fig for the rest of the house, but if someone damaged anything related to his photographs, well, I don't know what he would do." But aren't there other staircases leading upstairs? Surely the servants have another staircase?
Oh, yes, but a footman blocks that one as well. Sebastian is thorough. He would never take chances with his precious pictures.
Thea indicated which room was hers, and we went inside. I rang for a maid as Thea slowly lowered herself into a chair. "Your maid will be here soon," I said, as I turned off all the lights in the room, except for a single table lamp in a far corner. Thea spoke with her eyes closed as she massaged her temple with one hand. "My maid didn't accompany me. She's sick, and stayed in London with her sister."
"Would you like for me to ask for Muriel, then?"
"No, she's with the children. I'd rather she stayed with them. On a night like this, I know Paul'll be tempted to sneak out to watch the fireworks, and it's better she stay there to keep an eye on him."
Jane entered, throwing back the door. She caught it before it hit the wall and closed it gently. Jane stood for a second with her back to the room, and I saw her shoulders rise and fall as she took a deep breath. When she had helped me dress for dinner that evening, she'd been deferential and helpful, but as she turned, she had a different air about her. Her cheeks were flushed, and her eyes sparkled, but as soon as I explained Thea needed headache powders and possibly a sleeping draught, some of the pent-up energy that seemed to be buzzing around Jane faded.
"Yes, ma'am, I'll see to it."
I closed the door with a click, navigated around the party on the stairs, and returned to the ballroom. After the quiet dimness of Thea's room, the exuberance of the ballroom was a shock. Voices shouted over the din of blaring music, and the crush was so tight I could barely see beyond the four or five bodies packed around me. I pushed between two people and bumped into Tug. I said, "I've been looking for you." He leaned far too close and fanned me with sour, alcohol-laced breath.
"Brilliant! I say, care to dance?"
I thought of the £50 retainer Aunt Caroline had already paid me.
"Let's," I said.
At least it was an upbeat number, which meant I wouldn't have to fight to keep him at arm's length. The song was already half over, but we shoved through the throng to the dance floor. When I had a chance, I asked, "Have you known Alfred long?" He shook his head.
"I don't know where Alfred is."
"No," I said. Tug continued,
"He and Violet had a dust-up. Trouble in paradise, I think."
"Oh, dear," I said, diverted from my original train of thought. "What about?" An argument between Alfred and Violet might not be such a bad thing. If Alfred and Violet broke things off, Aunt Caroline and Gwen wouldn't have to worry any more. Of course, it would also mean I was out of a job. I pushed that thought away.
"No idea. A woman, probably."
"Why do you say that?"
"Well, Alfred is quite the ladies' man."
He blinked. The fact that I was Violet's relative must have risen through his alcohol-soaked brain.
"I mean, that..."
"Quite." I would have left him squirming, except he could be a good source of information about Alfred, so I rescued him.
"How long have you known Alfred?" I asked, shouting to be heard over the music.
"A while, I suppose. Hard to keep track of time, don't you know?"
"Where did you meet him?"
"At a party."
The song ended and a ripple of excitement flowed through the dancers along with the word fireworks. I was carried along with the tide as everyone rushed outside to watch the fireworks and Tug and I were separated. I wasn't actually that sorry to see him go. I broke away from the crowd and let them surge down to the lawn. I drifted across the terrace and down the stairs to the lawn, keeping an eye out for Gwen. The last time I'd seen her, she'd been in the ballroom, trying to keep an eye on Violet.
"Hello, Olive."
I turned and saw Monty. He raised his lighter to a cigarette, and the flame highlighted his face for a moment. He offered his cigarette case.
"Would you like one?"
"No, thank you."
He closed the case and tucked it away.
"I believe if we stand over here, away from these trees, we'll have the best view of the fireworks."
A whine cut through the air, and the sky above us exploded into a starburst of light.
"How are you enjoying the party?" I asked. Unlike Tug, Monty seemed to be as sober as he had been earlier in the evening. The tip of the cigarette glowed red, then Monty blew a stream of smoke away from me.
Sebastian always puts on a good show.
Several fireworks went off, one after another, sparkling against the black sky as the lake mirrored the explosions. A trace of acrid smoke drifted across the lake, but it wasn't enough to set off an asthma attack. Where is Sebastian? I haven't seen him.
Probably watching from one of the balconies. It's the best view.
Monty glanced over his shoulder at Archley Manor.
What the?
I swung around at the intensity of his tone. Two figures struggled on the balcony, silhouetted against the faint light coming from the open door behind them. It was impossible to distinguish anything more than a dark blur. The high-pitched drone of another firework lifting off sounded, then a bright explosion lit up the facade of the house. For just a moment, it revealed a man with dark hair in evening dress and a woman with short blonde hair in a sparkly dress. As the twinkling light of the firework faded, one figure went over the balustrade.
That was chapters 7 and 8 of Murder at Archley Manor, which was narrated by Elizabeth Klett. I'll be back week after next with the next chapters. If you want to continue the story, you can get it in an ebook, audio, or print at sarahrosettebooks.com, and that link will be in the show notes as well. Happy sleuthing, and I'll see you next time.